And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the latest edition of The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Bruce Feldman, joined, as always, by my colleague Stuart Mandel. And Stu, before we talk spring football and all the games that were this past weekend, I got to ask you, how much of the Sunday Masters coverage did you watch?
Well, if you're talking about, like, sit on a couch and watch uninterrupted, not very much. It was more one of those things where, as it became apparent that Tiger had a chance to win it, and I was at the gym and I found myself checking my phone a little bit more often, or, you know, watching it on the elliptical for 20 minutes and so on. I didn't actually get to see what happened until I watched like the last hour of the Encore broadcast. Because by that time, you know, the funny thing about Twitter is like I felt like I'd watched it, but I hadn't actually watched it, if you know what I mean.
Wait, so you didn't watch any of it live or very little of it live?
No, I was, first of all, I remember it started really early our time. And I was kind of on the go that morning. I kind of used up my recreational sports watching on the NCAA tournament and the spring games that we're about to talk about a little bit. But, you know, I'm not the world's biggest golf fan, but I'm not the world's any golf fan, but I do recognize the enormity of the moment. The one time in my life that I was kind of into golf would have been like the late 90s, early 2000s when he was really at his peak. So it's not like I haven't watched Tiger in a major tournament before. I mean, I tell you this much, I've read Mike Rosenberg and everybody else who's written a great story about him. So it's like I got into it, but it was almost too late. I got into it after all of you who watched it live.
Here's what I thought, just as somebody who played golf in college and covered it when I first started out as a reporter. So Tiger Woods, you know, had this machine-like quality for much of his dominance as a pro golfer. But the thing that kind of resonated with me as somebody who doesn't watch every PGA event at this stage of my life, was when you see him make the final putt to win, and then all of a sudden you see a complete change in his expression, and he goes and his 10 or 11-year-old son just basically jumps in his arms, and it's a really sweet moment. And I think what was really cool to see was, you know, you can talk about the comeback story and everything else, but just like such a human story, you know, in there. And again, I don't know, sometimes do you watch stuff differently because you're a parent now? Does it kind of, like, I know for me, I think, I'm not saying if you don't have kids, you cannot connect with this story or weren't moved by it. But I just felt like that was the part was like, whoa, I didn't see that coming. You're getting goosebumps at something that, I mean, I think it's great for golf and the sport when somebody who is such a huge draw, not just for his other golfers, but that moment was so memorable for me. Like that's the thing I will take away. So as you said, you're not a big golf fan, but I'm curious, aside from the sport we cover, which is obviously college football, what sporting events most stick in your mind where you're like, okay, I remember where I was when I saw that. And I'm not talking about like something horrible, horrific world catastrophe. I'm talking about just like the sporting event and maybe the I can't believe what I just saw quality of it.
Well, first of all, I do view everything differently, not just sports, but everything through the lens of a parent. In fact, just, you know, we're recording this on Monday, and unfortunately this morning was the awful fire in Paris, the Cathedral of Notre Dame, which I have seen in person and been to Paris many times. It's heartbreaking. And I hadn't thought of this, but Joan Neeson from SI tweeted how when she was a little girl, she loved reading the Madeleine books that are all set in Paris and have that as a backdrop. And she had the image. And when I saw it, I got the chills because our daughter is Madeleine, and I've read her those Madeleine books probably 800 times. And, you know, things like that, I never would have made that connection, right? Obviously, before I was a parent. You know, like I said, I didn't watch this live, but we were sitting at actually one of your favorite restaurants, Bruce, yesterday, just kind of happenstance, ended up at the counter. Is that still a favorite of yours?
Not quite, but I would go to one if there was one in my area.
It's not the greatest place. It's not the greatest burger joint by any means, but it's a good place to bring a three-year-old. And they had the TV on. The Masters was over, but they were showing the highlights. And my three-year-old has never seen golf ever. So I explained to her, I go, this is golf. And the questions she had were, she really liked when he hit it. She goes, I like it when he hits it in the hole. And I chuckled. And then she asked, her question was, why is he wearing red? Which obviously is a little hard to explain. But then the better question was, why is his jacket green and not red like his shirt? So that was my Masters moment Sunday. Okay, you asked me.
Give me the sporting events that most
where you were.
Yeah, and they're not college football related.
Well, I mean, most of them would have to do with when I was growing up, and I was a huge Cincinnati Reds fan and Bengals fan and Xavier basketball fan. Like, I remember where I was for almost any, you know, like the 1990 World Series championship and things like that. But are you talking about like a kind of
it could be anything. You know, for me, I'm a little older. I definitely remember the Miracle on Ice beating the Russians and Al Michaels' call. Mm-hmm. Because that had been such a dramatic build-up to that. I remember Kirk Gibson's home run in the World Series, where he hobbled around the bases, even though, you know, I wouldn't say I was a huge fan of either team or have anything invested. Like, I remember Steelers Super Bowls. I grew up a Steelers fan. I remember, you know, Lynn Swann's amazing catches and some of the back and forth with the Cowboys, certainly, in the Super Bowls. And I remember, I grew up in a fan where my brother was a Giants fan. I remember when the Giants finally beat the 49ers. But I'm just talking about something that was like, you know, like there's one of those things where you were talking about Xavier basketball and everything, where you're like, okay, this is personal to me. But then you're watching something that, like yesterday, I feel like it was a communal thing where you're watching something. Again, I don't want to force it on you because I don't think it was something that, you know, obviously you're not really that into golf. So, but like, I think for a lot of people, when you're watching it and everybody else is kind of, you know, wrapped in the moment, you know, the Kirk Gibson home run to me kind of was like that. Certainly, I think the Miracle on Ice was like that. The Buster Douglas fight had happened here and was not something where most people couldn't see it. You know, I remember the Buster Douglas upset of Mike Tyson happened, I think, the exact same time as Spud Webb winning the slam dunk contest. And I don't think either one of those was like as accessible to the TV audience as they are would be now. You know, whereas if this Buster Douglas Mike Tyson thing happened, even if you didn't pay for it, a lot of people probably would have watched it on Periscope for free or something.
Or you would have seen
that kind of deal.
To be clear, I fully recognize that yesterday was one of the biggest sports moments probably of my lifetime, just because I wasn't like pre-planning to sit down and watch the Masters. I mean, I feel like I was a little bit part of the communal experience, and I just by keeping up with it, you know, because remember, he was down to, what, was that like the 11th or 12th hole? He was still down to? And
well, when we came back, I had my son's baseball game. It was basically from 8:30 to 10 Pacific time. I came back, and he was in a five-way tie for the lead, I think, on the 14th hole. And all of a sudden, everybody else kind of fizzled. I mean, I'm watching Molinari just kind of, I don't say meltdown, but just really struggling.
Yep.
And he finished strong, whereas everybody else kind of fizzled. And about three holes, you're seeing, this is probably going to happen. And then it would take like a big collapse for him not to happen, you know, where all he has to do is bogey the last hole to win. We've already gone pretty far down the golf rabbit hole, but I just thought it was just such a really spectacular kind of thing that we just don't see very often in sports. As much as we see like big moments, this was like on another level, I thought.
I think in recent times, some of the best communal sports watching moments have been through the U.S. in the World Cups. You know, obviously they haven't gone very far, but, you know, and I'm not even, again, this is not a sport that I'm a huge fan of in soccer, but there's something about rooting for the U.S. Like, think about Landon Donovan's goal in 2010. I remember exactly where I was watching that, and Twitter was a thing at that point. Everybody just exploded. I can remember being at a sports bar in Brooklyn with 100, you know, it was a jam-packed place watching, I forget who they played in the, once they actually got out of group play, they lost that game. I remember being actually with you, I think, in Manhattan Beach when they lost, when they got eliminated in 2014. And those are the ones that stand out to me in terms of recent years. I also remember as a kid watching the Olympics when Jackie Joyner-Kersee burst onto the scene, when Mary Decker at the time, I believe, fell, and how shocking that was. So it's cool that we still have these, because obviously there's 8 gazillion other things you can be watching now, as opposed to maybe when we were growing up and there were 3 things on TV at any given time and everybody was watching one of them. But yeah, I would definitely say What Happened on Sunday would qualify as one of those.
Well, Stu, I know people listen to us for the college football coverage.
That's the thing. Though, so, I spent a lot of time watching sports on TV this weekend. It was exhibition football game.
Yeah. So, by the way, my son was excited to watch it, and then I had to explain to him, well, Alabama's playing Alabama, and that part was a little confusing to him. We're watching Michigan State. Well, Michigan State's playing Michigan State. Well, why is he wearing a black jersey? Well, that means they're not allowed to touch the quarterback, son. So it's just a little bit of a challenge. But, you know, look, we've talked about this a lot. You take these things with a grain of salt and try not to read too much into it. But what was the biggest takeaway of all the stuff you watched in college football this weekend?
So I'm actually somebody who does read in stuff into the spring games. Now, you have to, when you see the numbers, look at, all right, were they playing the first team defense or the second team defense?
Mm-hmm.
Every school does it a little bit differently. But I just feel like over the years, there have been a lot of cases where somebody had a breakout performance. I mean, I watched Trevor Lawrence's spring game last year and was like, yep, he'll be the starting quarterback within the first few weeks of the season. Jameis Winston had an amazing spring game his redshirt freshman year when he was competing with Jay Coker. So you do see these things translate. You see them the other way, too, where somebody really struggles and like, oh, that's not a good sign. I do think it's more obvious at a position like quarterback than it is. Good luck identifying the defensive players from one of these spring games, because in most cases, they're not allowed to do anything. You know, Ohio State, they weren't even tackling them to the ground. But, okay, let me start with Ohio State. Obviously, much has been made about Justin Fields. He and Trevor Lawrence were the standout recruits, quarterback recruits in last year's class, and he transfers from Georgia, and he's immediately eligible. He had a 98-yard touchdown pass in this spring game that was all that. I think he may have thrown it 40 yards downfield, and his receiver took it the rest of the way. But in general, he definitely looked like a work in progress. And I thought Doug Lamorese from Cleveland.com put it best. He was like, you know, last year it was Dwayne Haskins and Joe Burrow battling in this game, and they both went on to have, you know, to lead very successful teams. He's like, neither of these guys competing today, Justin Fields and Matthew Baldwin, would have beaten out Joe Burrow last year. So it's kind of like, yo, let's temper expectations here a little bit. This guy is probably not going to, he may end up being the starter and he may end up having a good season, but it's not going to be instant impact, I don't think, the way, I don't think he's going to have anything close to the kind of season Haskins had last year. Just, he seems like he's more of a work in progress.
I'm going to hold off on that. I think pump the brakes.
Well, you're not ready to make any conclusions about anybody from what I can tell.
Well, I just don't think you can read too much about, okay, this is, I think they're all work in progress, to be honest. I mean, nobody was going to predict Joe Burrow been where he's at right now, where people think he's going to have a really good career at LSU. And Dwayne Haskins threw 50 touchdowns, which I don't think anybody saw that coming out of last year's spring game. He looked good, but it wasn't to this degree, right? So,
can I just give you a quick point of comparison? I know you watched the Notre Dame game.
I did.
Ian Book, you know, returning starting quarterback, pretty good quarterback last year. Just, you know, he looked the part. He looks like a guy who is now entering his second full season as starter and is in complete command of the offense. That's not what you were seeing. First of all, that would be a very high bar to begin with. But, you know, there is a point of comparison when you're seeing a guy who is in kind of mid-season form versus a guy who played sparingly for Georgia last season and is still fairly young, clearly has all the talent in the world, but, you know, still has a lot of things to work on.
Well, one of the things that, unlike, again, I don't want this to be a negative on Dwayne Haskins, but a big part of Justin Fields' game is his legs. And we saw some of that, but can't really tell a ton of that in a game where he can't get tackled.
Right.
So whereas Dwayne Haskins, he's not beaten, contrary to what Stephen A. Smith once tried to say, he's not, that's not his game. He's not a mobile quarterback. So I think there's, you know, some guys, and I would put Justin Fields in this category. Sometimes you talk to coaches and they're like, we didn't know how good he was until the game started, because all the times where you think you're tackling him, and Kyler Murray fit into this category, you don't know how special he is until everything's going on real around him. And now I'm not saying he's going to, Justin Fields is going to win the Heisman this year like Kyler Murray did, but I do think this is where it can get a little, you get into a gray area with it. You know, Garrett Wilson, who was a highly touted receiver, definitely looked the part, made a great play.
He had a big time catch on one of those touchdowns.
It wasn't a Justin Fields throw. It was Matthew Baldwin, who's the other quarterback, who's basically the guy who's also a Texas kid from the Austin area, who is the guy who he's competing with for the job. You know, again, Ohio State's an interesting situation right now because half the staff is gone. You know, Mike Yurcich is now the quarterback coach there, and you got two new defensive coordinators, co-coordinators, and Greg Schiano has moved on. So we're going to see how all the pieces come, you know, fit together. Right now, I think Ohio State is, to me, the front runner for the Big Ten, but the school we didn't get to see is a very interesting one, and that's Michigan, because their spring game wasn't on TV.
It wasn't really even a spring game, I don't think. It was a practice with a little bit of scrimmaging at the end. One more name I wanted to mention with Ohio State, Master Teague. With Mike Weber gone, J.K. Dobbins is clearly the show, but obviously there's going to, you know, he's not going to do it alone. This guy, Master Teague, highly rated recruit, looks like he'll emerge as kind of the 1B to his 1A.
Marcus Crowley, also a guy to keep an eye on there too, the other running back.
Yeah, so all I saw of Michigan was one of their beat writers, Angelique Chingelis, tweeted some video she took of some of the plays they ran. And it did look like, the kind of offenses Josh Gattis has come from. A little more spread out, clearer run-pass option plays with, a little bit of tempo as well. So I think that's what everybody was most curious about with them. And we got just a tiny little taste of it.
You want to get back to Notre Dame? So I think we both are optimistic about Ian Book and Notre Dame and the offense there. Their offensive line, their tackles at least struggled with some really good edge rushers, I thought. But again, you know, we'll see what it looks like in the fall when it really matters. How optimistic are you about the Irish after last season?
Yeah, I mean, I think their offense should be really good. I know they lost Dexter Williams, but Jafar Armstrong looked great in that spring game, and he, you know, got off to a great start last year before injuries. You know, you've got some really good receivers like Chase Claypool. With Ian Book as quarterback, they should be really good on offense. The problem is if he gets hurt, because you and I were talking about this a little bit on offline. Poor Phil Jurkovec, you know, himself a fairly highly rated recruit the year before, got sacked 12 times. Now, granted, it's a spring game, you can't get touched. There were definitely a couple where I was like, that shouldn't be counted a sack. But others, he just held it and held it and held it to the point where Chris Sims, who was the color guy, would say, just throw it already. So that was a rough, you know, and our Notre Dame writer, Pete Sampson, wrote about that and what you should take from it. So, and then, like you said, the offensive line that second string offensive line wasn't able to hold up at all. So barring injuries, they should be pretty good on offense. Defense, they had a lot to replace, but I still think, you know, Jalen Elliott's a really good player. Like, I think Notre Dame should be really good again.
I think so, too. Question is, can they be great? And you know what? I don't think we're going to see anything in the spring that'll be able to give us a read on that.
Nope. I think you'll know everything you need to know about Notre Dame on September 21st when they go play Between the Hedges against the Georgia Bulldogs.
All right. That is definitely one to look forward to. We had a lot of other stuff from the spring. Anything else that, you know, we both watched a lot of stuff.
Yeah, well, we talked about Ohio State, Michigan. Let's talk about Penn State for a second. I tuned into that one for quite a while. First of all, shout out to Matt Millen, who made his triumphant return to the broadcast booth.
Yeah, and I think to me that was the most significant news that we got of anything that happened in spring football over the weekend, just after the heart transplant. I think it's pretty awesome that he is back and doing what he loves. And you could see him get emotional when Lisa Byington, who's his broadcast partner for BTN, was talking to him about just kind of the support he's gotten and the big crowd support he got when he was shown on the Jumbotron and all those things. And he was fairly bashful about the attention, but it's one of these human stories that I don't think you don't have to be a Penn State fan to be moved by, you know, this guy whose whole life has been football and quintessential tough guy and everything he's had to battle through. And now to see him back, I think that was, like I said, bigger than anything that happened on the field there.
Penn State's got a lot of good young talent. You know, Noah Kane is big time freshman running back, and you could see he's the part. I don't think he'll be the main guy right from the beginning.
Ricky Slade's back. They still have Ricky Slade. Mm-hmm. Ricky Slade's really talented. But they have recruited really well, and I think, you know, Micah Parsons was a big factor there last year as a true freshman. I think we're going to see a bunch of other guys. You're going to see a bunch of like 18 and 19 year olds who I think will make a big impact on the defense. Now, I don't know if they can be a top five kind of team, but if they can, you obviously have to replace a great quarterback there in Trace McSorley, and Sean Clifford. They're very high on him, and he did some good things this, you know, yesterday or two over the weekend. But obviously there's Tommy Stevens is in the picture as well. You know, once he gets healthy, you mentioned Noah Kane, Ricky Slay, they got KJ Hamler. They have a bunch of really good young receivers who didn't get a chance really to play much last year that they're going to be counting on. But I don't know. I'm fascinated to see what happens. We mentioned Michigan. You see some transition with certainly Urban Meyer moving on at Ohio State. I mean, do you think this is going to be a year where we have three teams in the top 10 from the Big Ten East?
I mean, I was just going to say, you mentioned earlier you think Ohio State's the front runner to win the Big Ten. They seem to go into every season with that status. I unfortunately jumped off the bandwagon last year when Urban Meyer got suspended and regretted that prediction. But I don't know that there's much separating those three teams going into this season because of the combination of Ohio State and all the change that you talked about, not just at quarterback, but in the coaching staff as well. And, you know, look, Penn State's been right there with them on the field the past 3 years. I think people might dismiss them a little bit because of no Trace McSorley, but there's still a lot of talent there. And then Michigan, who I swore I would never get back on their bandwagon ever again after last season's Ohio State game. But, you know, at least it does seem like Harbaugh is addressing the one thing I most wanted him to address in terms of modernizing his offense. So I think, yes, the answer to your question is yes. I think you could see three top 10 teams.
I'm pretty much with you on that. And I wouldn't roll out Michigan State. Their defense is really, really good. And Brian Lewerke, who was banged up last year, is back, new hairstyle, and seemed to have a good spring. We'll see what kind of talent is around him skills-wise. But I think their defense is so good that, to me, I know they're a top 25 team. I don't know if they have enough firepower as those other teams do, you know, to help their quarterback out. If they do, then I think they're right there too.
Now, let me ask you a question put on your TV broadcast hat. I assume you watched Alabama.
I did.
And
yes.
I assume you watched Clemson the week before.
I did.
So in both of those games, you know, a spring game is a chance to just kind of do things a little bit differently. Like Notre Dame did the whole game from the Skycam, which was kind of cool, I thought. Do you like it?
I did. I don't know if I would, you know, it's great for a spring game. I don't know if I would want to see the big Saturday night game that I'm all fired up to watch in that from that angle. I mean, you definitely see some plays develop that you don't from the more traditional view. But it was very interesting, and I was like, this is kind of cool. Again, to me, for a secondary, I don't know if it would be good for the primary.
It's a little bit jarring, obviously, since you've been watching football from a certain angle your whole life. But I will say, what you particularly see more of, and just to give people a sense here, since they probably didn't watch the Notre Dame spring game, the Skycam basically gives you the ability to move around a little bit before the snap. So it's not like a straight line necessarily. And what you could see was what the defense was doing. You could see who they were bringing. Mm-hmm. You could see what kind of coverage they were going to be in. So anyway, but Alabama and Clemson, the interesting thing there was in both games they had, in Clemson it was Herb Street and Galloway were on the field with mics. And they were talking to Dabo literally the whole, I don't think this was the plan, because they had a play-by-play guy. So it seemed like they intended for this to be kind of a once in a while thing. But basically Dabo being Dabo talked to them the whole entire game. And was saying, like, this is okay, they're going to run this play now. And then they would run the play. And he'd say, this guy did this right, this guy did this wrong. Or he would give you a little backstory on some of the younger players that were involved. And then Saban at Alabama, Laura Rutledge, at least a couple times when I was watching, got him, like, as a walk and talk as the game was unfolding. He was giving his little candid assessment. So I don't know. I thought that was an interesting way to watch it. To watch what is essentially a exhibition game as well. When are you ever going to hear Nick Saban's in-game thoughts?
Well, they also did that at the LSU one with Marcus Spears and Greg McElroy down on the field, which I thought was interesting because Marcus Spears is about as big as anybody in TV media, and he seemed to be a little concerned about somebody running into him, and I'm not sure there's anybody close to as big as him. So, but here's what I think as the spring games, and I've kind of ribbed you about this online. I think actually the most valuable stuff we get from the spring games is when the announcers are talking about these programs, because chances are they spent the last 36 or 48 hours before kickoff around these teams and talked to a bunch of people inside the program. So they have a really good perspective on what where these teams are, because the reality is a lot of these teams are not going to show much in that setting because they know the games are on TV. So you get to hear a perspective on the team that I think, to me, that's the part that is most valuable about any of these things. You know, it's the same reason why I love that Big Ten roadshow that Dave Revson and DiNardo and Howard Griffin do, is because they're there on the ground and you get to get access from it. I mean, and I think I've mentioned this to you and some of our colleagues at The Athletic, that to me, the best thing about when I go on the road in the spring, the only thing better than getting to watch practice is getting to watch film of the practice with the coaches, because you really hear, you get real insight into the personnel and who's doing what. And that's where I think, you know, like I said, I think it does bring value. And so I was interested to hear, especially Dabo. I mean, to me, Dabo was different than the other two broadcasts of Alabama and LSU, because he was really invested in what you're seeing. And I thought that was very interesting to hear his commentary and those guys back and forth with him.
It made it a little hard to follow the game, to be honest. But once you got used to it and accepted the fact that he was going to talk the entire time, I think you could tell ESPN was a little thrown off by it, because there were times when they had a lot of people there. They also had Marty Smith. And I swear there were a couple times when Marty Smith was interviewing Jeff Scott, the offensive coordinator who was calling the plays, but the mic was still live with Dabo and the other guys, and they were both happening at the same time. Anyway, it's just spring. Everybody's sorting out the kinks. This is not a spring game, but actually a scrimmage I wanted to ask you about at your alma mater. Tate Martell, It's been the word all spring has been that Tate Martell is really struggling. And at this open spring scrimmage they had the other day, it got so bad that he was getting booed at one point, which seems really extreme, that if the fans, and who knows if it was 10 people or 100, I don't know, the fans would boo their own quarterback in a spring scrimmage. I'm not entirely surprised that he's not necessarily the savior, but I think it's unfortunate. I mean, we talk about this sometimes. I don't, they're not pro athletes. I don't think any college quarterback deserves to be booed, especially not by his own fans, at a spring scrimmage. So how much of that, though, do you think is a product of his persona, for better or worse?
I think the expectations are pretty high. Again, like you said, we have no idea what the context of it was, how much it was. He was 3 of 9 with an interception. And from just digging around it a little bit, they were without their starting center and two of their best receivers, plus their most talented tight end. So I don't think any of the quarterbacks there lit it up, but I'm sure some of it is, I don't want to say he has a brash personality, but he has a strong online, you know, Twitter personality, and that preceded him before Ohio State. So, look, I think the expectations there are really high because of that, but he's not the expected starter right now. Nikosi Perry is the guy I think has a little bit of the lead going in, and that might surprise some people on the on the outside of it. And I think because people said, oh, this guy was a former five star and he just got, you know, eligible, the NCAA cleared him, that they just automatically assumed, you know, this isn't Jalen Hurts transferring to Miami. This was a largely unproven player who had some moments at Ohio State, but, you know, it was not like he was going into games and lighting it up. So I think you have kind of a weird mix of things going on there, right? I mean, Miami's offense stunk before. I don't know how much better it's going to be in 2019. I mean, it helps that they have Jeff Thomas back, but Jeff Thomas didn't play this weekend. So I don't know what to expect from
him. I think there's a little bit of panic setting in, because there was an expectation that he would come in and start right away. You know, there's a reason he filed for the waiver. There's a reason they went out and got a transfer like him in the first place, because the quarterbacks they had, you know, were a problem last year. So now there's a little bit of panic in that, it doesn't look like this guy's even the starter right now. He may even be the second or third stringer. But I also think that, I don't know. I've never seen quite a thing where so many people are rooting against him. I guess because he's outspoken on Twitter, like you said. I don't think Ohio State fans like the way he handled announcing to everybody at the Rose Bowl that, bring it on, when Justin Fields transferred in and then transferred. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. This was not a one practice thing, by the way. I mean, Manny Navarro has been covering the whole spring camp for The Athletic, and a lot of his stories have been to the effect of how much Tate Martell is struggling as a passer. So we shall see what comes of that.
Before we move on, can we talk about one other five-star transfer quarterback?
I love talking about five-star transfer quarterbacks.
I know you do. So
are you talking about the guy in Oklahoma?
No, I'm not. We'll talk about him plenty. But sky-high expectations, Jacob Eason.
Yep.
But if you read from people who are close to the coverage on Washington, Jake Haynes, who looks kind of like a walk-on, he's not. He was the backup last year, has been the guy who's been the most impressive, apparently.
That would be quite the development.
Well, again, I mean, you talk to people around Georgia, they were not as gung-ho on Jacob Eason. He's big and he's got a big arm, but there's a lot more to play in the position than that. So if you're a Washington fan, are you just like, hey, I know Chris Peterson, the best guy's going to play? How do you read this situation right now?
Well, I think it's a different situation. And the one we were talking about at Miami, you saw who the other choices were last season. If Tate Martell's not better than those choices, that's a problem. Whereas at Washington, you're replacing a four-year starter.
But he's not the starter. That's the point.
No, but the point is, you know, I think, yes, five-star transfer, we all assumed he'd be the guy by default. But, you know, Chris Peterson has been recruiting other quarterbacks this whole time. It's not inconceivable that the best guy on the roster is not the transfer, but somebody that he recruited in the last couple of years.
This is a tweet from our friend Brock Heward, who knows the University of Washington football probably about as well as anybody in the media, towards Mike Varell, who's one of their beat writers now. Jacob Eason took the first starting snaps, but Jake Haner went 14 of 17 in scrimmage drills, completed his first 13 passes. He was the more crisp and accurate of the two, at least today. Brock Heward's response to that: been this way from what I'm hearing most of the first few weeks of spring. Puts UW and Chris Peterson at a crossroads. Does the best man win, or does the player with the most upside, yet still most to prove, win? The reps remaining the spring will be a fascinating study and tell.
I mean, I think Chris Peterson's probably the last coach who would decide who his starter is based on the recruiting rankings, right?
Absolutely, because think of who his most successful quarterback of all time was. That would be Kellen Moore, who kind of has some Jake Haner-ish physical, you know, appearance in terms of just very, very average, but was a phenomenal college quarterback. I'm not saying Jake Haner is going to be the next Kellen Moore, but to your point, that was a guy who really, really thrived, and we'll see if Jake Haner ends up pulling a big upset and becoming the starting quarterback there.
That would be one of the bigger upsets in quarterback competitions in recent memory. But now remember, Jacob Eason's from there, so I don't care what his stature is coming out of Georgia. Clearly, if he wanted to transfer to Washington, Washington was going to take him. This wasn't a case of we don't have any quarterbacks, we desperately need somebody. You know, this wasn't a guy that was going to play right. He sat out a year, so we'll see. Let the best man win. It would definitely be quite the career trajectory for Jacob Eason if he goes from a true freshman starter in the SEC to a backup as a fourth-year player in the Pac-12. Should we get to the mailbag?
We should.
Okay, this one comes from Mike Buckland, pronounced Buckland, from Savage, Minnesota. Hi, Stu and Bruce. With spring football concluding, there are a few spring games left, Mike, including Georgia's next week and Washington's the week after, but you're right, it's starting to wrap up. Are we officially in the nearly 5-month doldrums for college football diehards? To give us light at the end of the tunnel, which games are you each most looking forward to in the first few weeks of the season? I know my answer because I was just at this place.
I think that we're going to have the same answer because I was at the other place.
That's true.
Go Stu.
That's true. You're right. LSU at Texas, week 2. By the way, Bruce, you're going to be very jealous, but you remember I wrote about Torchies in the mailbag last week?
They sent you food and coupons.
Torchies tweeted at me and said...
Oh, that's no big deal. Torchies tweeted at me, too.
They said, come back on September 9th. We hear there's a big game in town. And I think I might take them up on that. But, yeah, it's one of those games where, you know, these are both programs that are desperate and hungry to compete for national championships and make it into the playoff. And I think this game will say a lot about the state of those two teams and what position they're in. Sam Ehlinger has a chance to maybe put himself high up in the Heisman contention if he has
a good game. What did you just say?
Ehlinger.
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, I thought you said Ehlinger again.
I've been told that I've been mispronouncing his name for about a year now, but I was just there, and actually I was on the radio. I was at the Austin station, interviewed me after my story on him went up, and I kept hearing him say it over and over again, Ehlinger, Ehlinger, Ehlinger. So I confirmed at the end just to make sure we're all on the same page here. But that doesn't mean I won't slip into Ehlinger mode every so often.
So if you were the Vegas odds, what's the point spread on that game?
I actually saw what the early point spread on that game is. It was LSU -5 on the road, which was a little surprising.
It's surprising to me, too, because it is on the road. What would you make it?
Probably more or less. I mean, I do think LSU is the favorite. There's understandable skepticism with Texas. How many times have we heard in the last decade that Texas is back? But I definitely think Texas has the better quarterback. And there's going to be some guys we haven't seen much of to this point having a big impact in that game. But I'd say like LSU -2.
Okay, because that game is, if that game wasn't a neutral site, I think LSU would be the favorite. I'm a little surprised that they're not the favorite. Maybe by the time we get closer to that game, that'll swing closer to Texas. Texas has more question marks on defense. That, I think, is the difference. Both teams beat Georgia. LSU beat them soundly, and Texas beat them pretty good, too. That game wasn't that close until the end. But, yeah, that to me, that's the most intriguing matchup of the early season. And I think also what's on the line there, that is a huge game for the Big 12.
Yep.
Now, because it's an SEC Big 12 matchup, it's at a Big 12 site, the way Texas finished last year. And also, I mean, Sam Ehlinger is in the thick of the Heisman race. I think he will make a run at the Heisman. I'm really interested to see Keontae Ingram, you know, what he can do as a sophomore. I watched their Texas spring game, and one of the people on with Lowell Galindo, one of the analysts said, you know what, they expect him to make the same leap Sam made from freshman to sophomore year. If Ingram does that, Texas might be a playoff team. You know, because I really think that's the kind of counterpunch they need to Colin Johnson is going to be a problem for defenses. Ehlinger brings a lot to the game from his own physicality in the run game. That's a really dangerous offense. And so I count me in on that one as well.
Let me ask you a quick thing related to when you said about Sam and the Heisman race, and I brought it up as well. But I think we would both agree that Trevor Lawrence and Tua are kind of in a class of their own in terms of the way they're viewed and the hype surrounding them right now. So in a scenario where, let's say, both Clemson and Alabama make the playoff again, and let's assume both those guys are healthy the whole year, what's the scenario where Sam or any other guy breaks that stranglehold? Like, doesn't it seem like one of those two would almost certainly win the Heisman?
We've seen this almost every year now where somebody comes off the radar and the favorite doesn't win it.
Right.
I mean, nobody was talking about Kyler Murray last year, right? So, I mean, you know, this is the same lesson over and over again. I think one thing that happens a little bit is, and I'm not saying that either one of these quarterbacks won't have a fantastic year, but the expectations builds where it almost becomes like, and again, this isn't like Bryce Love's year was like derailed by injury and everything, but like when you have so much of a buildup, man, it's hard to live up to that, right? People start to pick, you know, find the flaws and find stuff that may not be there. It's just the expectations are sky high. So if Sam Ehlinger lights up a good LSU defense and they win that game, he's going to be right there in the Heisman race because he means as much to that team as his team. And, you know, like Clemson was great before Trevor Lawrence showed up. Alabama was great before Tua showed up. Now, those places made those offenses better. But Sam is a different animal there. I mean, you could say he's as valuable to that program as any player is in the country. So,
oh, yeah. I mean, that was the theme of my story there the other day, was just how much he means to that program and to that city. And I agree. The crazy thing is last year, the three Heisman finalists, right, were Kyler Murray, Dwayne Haskins, and Tua. And none of them had started a game the year before. So that just tells you that you could put out all these preseason lists, but these guys can come from anywhere. The only thing is, usually that requires the front runners to slip up at some point, right? Trevor Lawrence has to lose a game at some point. Tua has to either lose a game or, you know, maybe
Tua didn't lose a game last year, though.
He had the ultimate, what could everything that could go wrong except that his team still won the game, contributed to him losing, obviously. Maybe this year his stats are way down because it doesn't click with Sark, or I don't know, whatever. Any of those things. Look, if Alabama goes 9-3, he's not going to win the Heisman. But it's another year where it's 13-0 Clemson and 13-0 Alabama, it's going to take a lot for somebody outside of those two to rise in there. The other thing I wanted to bring up, Texas, the reason that point spread is what it is, preseason FPI rankings, which nobody knows how they're calculated. Take them for what they're worth, but they tend to be in kind of not that different than Vegas's rankings. LSU is fourth, and Texas is not in the top 25 at all.
Okay, so this is the ESPN FPI rankings?
That is, but let me give you just to show you that it's not unique to them.
Let me throw one at you, and you explain it to me then.
Mm-hmm.
Who's number 15 on the FPI rankings?
Yeah, I can't explain that to you. The Tennessee Vols.
I saw that, and I was like, I don't understand that at all. I get it. They have 10 starters back, and I actually think Jarek Guarantano is pretty good. But, I mean, that was a team that went 5-7 last year. I know the schedule's easier, but how do they make them 15th?
Recruited. So if you notice, there's a whole lot of SEC in here. And I think that's because recruiting rankings play a big part in these preseason rankings. But let me just pull up Bill Connolly's preseason S&P as a point of comparison. It's another, you know, preseason power ranking, the one that John Feinstein went off on because Army wasn't ranked high enough. All right, in his rankings, LSU is fourth, Tennessee is 21st, and Texas, 35th. I have a theory. In terms of
stats are for idiots.
Texas, if you look back at last season, won a lot of close games. I think 6 or 7 one-score wins. But also, as Tom Herman pointed out to me, they were one of the least explosive teams in the country. And so the fact that Ellinger had 16 touchdowns is in part rushing touchdowns is in part because their running backs didn't break off big plays at all. And explosiveness definitely factors into Bill's ranking. So, you know, they won 10 games. To their credit, they won 10 games, but they did it without being a very explosive team. And I think you mentioned Keontae Ingram. He's one of several guys who they feel like will help change that this year. Should we move on to a different college football team?
Sure.
Oh, well, real quick, he asked for both of us to say the game we're most looking forward to in the first 2 weeks of the season, and we both said the same game. Should we perhaps throw one other one out there?
Okay. Is it a Michigan game? Because I'm very interested to see Michigan, but you already mentioned, we already kind of alluded to the Michigan-Georgia match.
Are you talking about Michigan-Army or Michigan? Because Michigan-Notre Dame play next year, but it's not till late October.
Michigan-Army is the same weekend as Ohio State-Cincinnati, by the way, which I think both are kind of interesting under-the-radar matchups.
Oh, I wonder what time they'll be if you could go to both.
I don't think you can go to both.
I mean, that's probably not. That's probably a little bit too far a drive. Maybe if you had a helicopter. Well, we mentioned Georgia-Notre Dame, obviously. What about, okay, I'll give you one. Auburn-Oregon, week one at Jerry World. I was talking about with somebody this week. You're a big Justin Herbert guy, right? Love him.
Pretty big. I don't think he would have been first pick in the draft, though. I think the hype got a little too overblown on that one.
So I have not yet managed to watch an Oregon game where Justin Herbert dominated. I know he has had those games, but the games I've watched, he has not. And unfortunately, my last memory of him was in that awful bowl that you and I were both at with Michigan State. What was it, 7-6?
It was 7-6.
Yeah. So I want to see what it's all about. And Auburn's going to have a pretty good defense. Derek Brown's back. So, you know, is this the game where Justin Herbert's going to have his big kind of here's what the NFL is all excited about game on national TV?
Yeah, in that game, Stu, basically the MVP of the game was Dylan Mitchell, who was really his go-to guy, but really the only receiver he could lean on. Dylan Mitchell moved on to the NFL, but from talking to Oregon staff, they are excited about two of the receivers they have who are newcomers, Micah Pittman, who is an early enrollee, very physical freshman, and Juwan Johnson, who's like a power forward size kid, grad transfer from Penn State. I think they will both help him a lot. The O-line should be good. But again, I'm with you a little bit. You know, we had a Justin Herbert game where he played very well against Nebraska, but that turned out to be a pretty awful Nebraska team. That was in Mike Riley's last season. Michigan State is a good defense. There's no taking away from that. But yeah, if he's going to be the guy that a lot of people thought was a, you know, top 10 kind of talent, we need to see a lot more from him. And I think that's going to be a good test because it's not just Derrick Brown. He's great. That is a great defensive line Auburn's got back. They always have athletes. We don't know who their quarterback's going to be. That's a big battle there, you know, between Joey Gatewood and Bo Nix is there. And then they have two other guys in contention. So that's plus, I mean, beating Auburn, if you're Oregon, is not going to like change the image of the Pac-12, but they need to have some of these things sooner than later, right?
Oh, they're so rare that they get to play a Pac-12 SEC game. So yeah, they could definitely use it. Also, before Oregon Ducks fans crush me on Twitter, I do now, I did watch one game where Justin Herbert was outstanding, the Stanford game where he completed some insane number of passes in a row, but they lost. So kind of marred it a little bit, but he was pretty outstanding in that game. Bruce, we have now, this is 5 years we've been doing the Audible, I think, almost 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I think this question is the most Bruce question we have ever received. This is the question you were born to answer. Ready?
Okay, yeah.
Ryan Griffith, and by the way, the subject is, quote, once they get into a weight room. Ryan Griffith, hey folks, when discussing college recruiting, you always hear about, quote, once we get them into a college weight room and how players will transform in the first couple of years. Similarly, I sometimes hear about players will change, quote, once they're in an NFL weight room. How different is the weight training and nutrition culture and support between elite high school program, Power 5 school, and NFL?
I definitely think it varies because you hear of some kids who come from a program and from high school and they're already really well developed. And this is a case in point. Alabama signed the number one, according to 247, defensive lineman in the country. He came from New Jersey, Antonio Alfano. He's already there. The guy who created the biggest buzz inside that program so far is a guy named DJ Dale. The defensive lineman has drawn some comparisons to Daron Payne. And so I was talking to a coach who's been there who I would trust his opinion on this subject about as well as anybody. And he said DJ Dale is phenomenally well coached, just great with his hands, plays with the base. Just whoever he had in high school did a remarkable job with this kid. And so sometimes you get that where they come out that well developed and everything. And other times, and I go back to the meat market days for this, I remember Ole Miss was recruiting one linebacker, and the recruiters in that area said, there's a kid from Florida, he goes, he eats two meals a day, and one of them is Skittles. You know, it's like, basically, when we get him here, he will get on a nutrition plan, and he will, you know, we'll be able to feed him better than what he's getting at home, and that's all part of it. And I think sometimes you see guys, you're like, how did this guy put on 30 pounds of muscle? And you'll see people on Twitter go, that's impossible. Well, it's not impossible if, you know, what they were used to was just not what, you know, most people are typically expecting. And so I think you see that from time to time. And it varies from program to program. I mean, we have plenty of examples of guys who come from Iowa and the development that they have there. Kirk Ferentz puts into his guys in terms of the expectations and how they develop and how they first evaluate the athlete, but also how they develop them. That's real. I mean, we see so many examples of guys who may not have been highly recruited and turn out to be big time NFL talent. And I think, you know, I was in Nebraska last week and it reminded me of my last trip there where Scott Frost talked about that was the piece, a big part of what's been missing in Nebraska. They just were not physically developing those guys in the weight room the way he was used to and the way they were under Tom Osborne. I think a lot of that has changed. And so, you know, you don't have to have Alabama's resources to have a great, you know, strength and conditioning program. I think that's the part that, you know, sometimes you get hung up on, okay, this guy was a five-star at high school, but you don't know. You can get that development in a lot of different places if they have a proven plan and the kid really buys in. I mean, Andre Diller is a great example. He may be the first offensive lineman taken. And when he was in high school, he was a 6'4", 240-pound guy that Washington State rolled the dice on. And now he was, whatever, 6'5", 315, and still super athletic. So I don't think it has to be this particular school, but I think you have to have the buy-in and the belief. And to me, that's part of it. As far as the NFL side, I think that that's another part of the equation, because so many guys go outside on their own to do a lot of that. I mean, I go out to UCLA from time to time. You see a ton of NFL guys training there in the off season because it's where they live. It's not like in college where you're around the same facility 11, 12 months out of the year.
I just randomly remembered, we talked about all these spring games. You were actually at USC for, what, their last practice of the spring?
Second to last practice, yeah.
And you were very complimentary of them on Twitter for a team that, you know, a lot of people are very down on right now. So why don't you give us some of the lowdown?
Yeah, I'm glad you framed it that way, because I came away thinking, and I don't know if it's because the bar for me in my mind was so low. Like, I don't know if I was expecting to see, I forgot what the team, the Texas State Armadillos or whatever that team that Scott Bakula coached. Like, in part of it was like, was I going to show up, expect to see like a ragtag group? But they, a couple of things. They just, this is the obvious. You come away going, oh, of course they have players. It's USC. I mean, they've recruited a bunch of kids for the last 4 years. They still have them. So when you look, they don't have 10 great receivers, but they have four or five who match up with anybody. When you look at Pittman and Devon Williams and Amon-Ra St. Brown and Tyler Vaughns, I mean, that's as good a first four as anybody else has. Got a bunch of big athletic guys in the front seven, and I would expect a big year from Jake Tufele. I'd expect a big year from EA Naote Ote, who they're really excited about. The part that I'm not sure of with them is, again, their offensive line, which has been underwhelming for a long time. We'll see. In the secondary, they're missing their two best defensive backs. But the vibe around the place was very upbeat and positive. And when I talked to people inside the program, I was like, well, what exactly changed? The biggest thing that, you know, you hear people put their finger on is some of the new assistants they brought in probably are a little more upbeat and brought a different energy than the guys they replaced. And people are very excited about what Graham Harrell brings there, not just the offensive system, but even talking to Clancy Pendergast, who is the defensive coordinator who was there before, just said, I think our guy is going up against it, and the identity and knowing what they're getting and kind of being able to use it as a benchmark helped them a lot. So they have talent. I don't know. I still don't change my opinion. I think they're probably an 8-4, 9-3 kind of team, but I don't know, you know, I don't know who's going to be the quarterback. I mean, the default is probably JT Daniels. I think there's a lot of people at USC or inside USC were hoping Jack Sears would kind of take it over. And he's had some up and down practices. And I think that's been a little bit.
Wait. Why do people already want to throw out JT Daniels? This guy was the second coming a year ago.
What do you mean the second coming?
He was the big time recruit who reclassified, who started from day one as a true freshman. I know they weren't that good last year, but he was still a true freshman. So I just assume that he will not only be the quarterback, but with the help of Graham Harrell, could be a very, very good quarterback. And you're telling me some people want him benched?
I think there's some people there around the program and inside the program who think Jack Sears might have more upside on it. Jack Sears is a more athletic quarterback, but he's honestly been not as consistent. JT Daniels throws it pretty well. He's a smart kid. But again, I think even the high school kid who's an early enrollee, Keaton Slovis, he's been a pleasant surprise. I think he's been better than they thought. He throws it as well as any of them. So I don't want to say it's a four-horse race. My guess is it probably will be JT Daniels. But I think the quarterback battle is closer than people probably would assume from the outside in. And it sounds like from where you're coming from with it is definitely closer than you probably would think. Just one other thing on the Jack Sears thing. I think people were very impressed with what they saw in the little bit he did play last year. And so I think that added to the intrigue of his talent. And maybe this is a function of, oh, the backup quarterback's always the most popular guy and the guy everybody, you know, can't wait to see, because you don't really know necessarily his flaws. Where the starter, maybe people are looking at it a little differently.
Another question where you are expertly equipped to answer, from James Birdsong. Hey, Bruce and Stu, do you find it strange that Ruffin McNeil's only had one stint as a head coach? Here's a quick recap of his six-year career at East Carolina. Went 42-34 overall and 30-18 in conference. Made a bowl game in four of his 6 years. beat several Power 5 teams, all with at least six wins, NC State, UNC twice, and Virginia Tech twice, hired Lincoln Riley as his offensive coordinator. After his dismissal, his replacement went 9-26 and 4-20 in conference play. Maybe I'm overlooking how much Lincoln Riley contributed to his success. Maybe he wasn't recruiting at a high enough level. To me, though, it seemed like this would be a nice hire for an above-average Group of Five program. P.S. I am not Ruffin McNeil, just someone trying to understand why he hasn't gotten another job.
Hey, he did. That was a bonehead decision. I think some people there actually thought, oh, we'll be able to hire Lincoln Riley back, not knowing Lincoln Riley's relationship with Ruffin McNeil. So I think for a lot of people, they looked in and go, well, Ruffin McNeil's age, they weren't sure if he was going to be another guy that they would, that somebody else would hire. I'm not sure what the job is that Ruffin would be in line with, because when you get fired from East Carolina, you know, where's your next stop? It's not going to be at a Power 5 job. So, and at this stage of his career, I think he's very comfortable being a trusted advisor to Lincoln Riley at OU. I mean, he's very close to Lincoln's family. I know he's very close to Dennis Simmons, who's also on the staff's family. So I think, you know, I think there's a lot of people he's really close to. Benny Wiley, the strength coach, is another old Texas Tech guy. So I my gut feeling on this, and I haven't talked to Ruffin about it specifically in a while, but the way that whole thing ended at East Carolina was pretty awkward. And I think it was tough on him and his wife. I don't know what the job he would get, be able to get as a head coach, but I'm not sure if it would satisfy him or, you know, be as comfortable for him as the one he has right now.
Fair enough. Let's wrap up with a question about a certain school in Evanston, Illinois, from Derek Johnson. Stu and Bruce, with the completion of Northwestern's shiny new practice facility, is it not fair to take them out of the scrappy underdog category and into a program that should expect to win 6 to 8 games a year between, say that they've won that many or more the last
year. I know.
Between Pat Fitzgerald's success, the facility, and prominent Northwestern alums on two of the most popular ESPN programs of the last 16 years, talking Northwestern up, he's referring to Mike Wilbon and Mike Greenberg respectively, Northwestern's only mild disadvantage is low attendance at a bad stadium. And as a Nebraska fan, I actively desire for Nebraska to blow Northwestern out, not just beat them this year. So congrats on that. What am I being congratulated on? Oh, the comeback last year, probably. All right. Well, maybe I should take this one at first.
Can I just throw out, like, I don't think the last point about whether the two ESPN personalities talking them up, I don't think that does anything to me.
Except annoy people.
That's a moot point.
I'm fully aware of how insufferable the Northwestern media mafia has become, especially after the NCAA tournament run a couple years ago. And I was guilty of that during the basketball. But even I cringe a little bit about those guys and football. You know, I think it's tough for you and I to put ourselves in the shoes of an 18-year-old and try to picture how Northwestern's visualized now. But needless to say, you know, they were not alive during the years when they were awful. Now, I know they don't look at them as Alabama by any means, but at this point, I think most people under a certain age or people who've just been following, you know, college football very closely know Northwestern as Pat Fitzgerald and a program that goes to a bowl game pretty much every year and was in the Big Ten title game last year. So I think the question he's asking is kind of outdated. Like, they're already expected to win 6 to 8 games a year. I think the more difficult question, and the one I would ask you, is it realistic with the fancy facility and a really good coach and all of that to take it the next level up? Or will Northwestern, that once for whom winning 9 or 10 games a year was once a historical aberration, are they good enough to do what Stanford has done over the last 8 years or so?
I don't know. That is the better question. Stanford wins big recruiting battles. You know, I remember my crew did a bunch of Northwestern games last year, and one of the things that was a common thread was a lot of guys, including Isaiah Bowers, including their Montre Hardage, who was their best defensive back, they were guys who, like, Northwestern was their only Power 5 offer. And so the question is, can they win some of these recruiting battles? Stanford wins a lot of them. To me, Stanford's on another level from almost every other place like that. If a kid is a high academic kid and he's a really good football player, Stanford is really, really hard to beat. And they're just different. And, you know, when you started talking about, before you said the part about these kids weren't alive when Northwestern was horrible. I thought you were going to say, I think Evanston is a really cool little town. There's a lot of charm there. It's nice. The training facility is really nice. The game day atmosphere there is a different deal. You know, if you're going to bring a kid on an official visit weekend, and then he goes to the game on Saturday, and he's going to compare it, let's say they're recruiting against Notre Dame, let's say they're recruiting against Michigan, that's a tough thing to handle. Their facilities maybe is not on the water, but at the same time, their facilities are really nice in other places too, but their game day experience is going to be way different than what you're going to show a kid if you go to a Northwestern game on a Saturday.
One thing I've learned over the years covering this sport, recruiting doesn't really change. Who does well in recruiting really doesn't change that much anymore relative to what happens on the field, right? I mean, Texas, mediocre for a decade, still recruiting top five classes. And USC has been pretty mediocre, still recruiting top five classes. Those are just the schools that get the big name recruits. And then I'll give you a good example on the opposite end of the spectrum. I was at Oklahoma State recently. Oklahoma State's been winning 10 games a year, practically almost every year, not last year, but for most years before that, for a decade, and they still can't beat Oklahoma or Texas for recruits. It's just the way it is, right? So Northwestern is not going to beat Ohio State, Michigan for recruits. They often are, like you said, they often are signing guys who don't have another Power 5 offer. They're often, you know, keep in mind, their pool is limited in the first place to guys that can get into the school, but you know, that's who they have to deal with. So they're always going to have to be a little bit scrappy and a little bit of an overachiever. But I do think that at this point, they have enough of a recent history to shoot, to aim a little bit higher than maybe they have in the past. But I'll tell you what, your point about the stadium is absolutely right. It's not a good game day atmosphere, to say the least. And it is what it is. You know, they've tried everything. And at the end of the day, they can't get more than 25, 30,000 Northwestern fans there. Now, if they're playing Ohio State, they'll sell out, but half the stadium will be red, if not more than half. So that definitely plays a role in recruiting.
You know who's in that example, by the way, that's interesting? You know, I don't want to say it's a counter to what you just said about like who everybody who's kind of the usual suspects do well in recruiting. Mm-hmm. Purdue had a top 25 class last year under Jeff Brohm, and they had some significant wins head-to-head against other people. So that's one that is kind of one that is, I would say, flared up, but it's like that would get people's attention that they did, you know, that they did better than Wisconsin and Virginia Tech and Miami and, you know, some other schools like that, that you would probably think have more traditional success. To me, that's one that is one that kind of broke through a little bit.
It just came out last week that Jeff Brohm is now the third highest paid coach in the Big Ten with his new contract. So Purdue's all in on football. You know, they're signing top 25 classes. They're paying their coach, you know, high money, to say the least. So we'll see if that can become more than a one-year thing. You know, you do see, you know, in any given year, you'll see some schools that perform much better than they usually do, but then they tend to revert back. I mean, Wisconsin has been good for 20 years, and they're still the school that finds the under-the-radar guys and the two, like, they're not getting, you know, five-star kids to come to Wisconsin. So it's just, I don't know. I can't really explain it. The reputations or the statuses of the programs and recruiting don't change much from year to year. And so when we talk about, you know, Kirby Smart coming to Georgia and elevating their recruiting, well, he's elevating it from number 7 to number 1. You know, he didn't take over a program that was a recruiting dumpster fire or turn them into the, you know, there's just, it's incremental, the changes that these coaches make.
All right, Stu, I'm going to give a shout-out this week.
Oh, wow. You should have warned me. I haven't haven't done one of those in a while.
Shout-out to Brandon Silvers. He's the old Troy quarterback who won in Baton Rouge, but that's not why we're doing the shout-out. Shout-out is because he got signed by the Jets out of the Alliance, the AAF.
I knew I recognized that name. That's why.
Here's what's kind of remarkable about this. You know who the other three quarterbacks on his team were?
Yeah, shoot, I just saw this.
I'm going to give you a who's who.
They were much higher, names you would recognize much more so than his.
So one is Zach Mettenberger, who had the two probably best receiver combination of anybody in college. Another one is Christian Hackenberg from Penn State, who obviously was former five-star himself. And the third one was the beloved John Manziel, the former Heisman Trophy winner from Texas A&M and first round pick.
And of all of them, he's the one that got signed.
Yes.
Well, that.
What would 2014 have thought about this reality that Brandon Silvers, who I think was a 2 or 3 star recruit at Troy, is the guy the NFL wants right now?
One day there will be books written about Christian Hackenberg. One of the more puzzling, I think we at this point can call him a bust, right? One of the more puzzling quarterback busts of recent history, in that he actually started out on his first year at Penn State, he was great. And then it just went downhill from there. And then there was this note. Remember, before James Franklin started getting it going there, there was a faction of fans who already hated him because they thought he ruined Christian Hackenberg. But then things didn't get any better in the NFL. And now you're telling me he wasn't even the best team on his best quarterback on his AAF team.
Yeah, and again, I would imagine some of this is, or maybe a lot of this is, to, you know, his confidence taking a big hit, and he didn't seem to rebuild it. Obviously, Johnny Manziel had some issues beyond just that he's been dealing with from his end of his Texas A&M time to the NFL to now. But yeah, it's kind of crazy to watch who, I don't want to say who emerges from this, but just. That was fascinating to me, and it's not to say that Silvers is going to turn out to be the starter of the Jets, because obviously Sam Darnold's their guy, but just the fact that he got it on there. John Wolford, I think, is on with the Rams, the Wake Forest quarterback. So there's been some positive stuff that came out of the league that went belly up last week.
As always, send your questions to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We'll come back next week with some more spring football hot takes after we watch. It's kind of crazy. Most of the games were this past weekend. There's only a few left already at this point, but a few notable programs still to go. And next week we'll come back, and I'll tell you all the big conclusions I've made, and Bruce will tell you to take them all with a grain of salt. No response.
I got one question for you.
Yeah.
We made it through this podcast without you bringing up Rick Ross and Les Miles. How did that happen?
That's a good point. We could have devoted a whole other section of the podcast to some of the entertainment that went down in some of these spring games. Ludacris played at Texas. The Les Miles Rick Ross thing was, what did you think?
Just from going out to practices, Rick Ross's music is played more than anybody else that I can think of when you're out there. So the idea that they got him probably resonated with their players more than almost anybody else they could get.
I just hope Les wins. I really do. Because so far this offseason, he's been doing all kinds of stuff like this, and it's very less. But I do wonder or worry that he's almost becoming a caricature of himself at this point. When he was doing this stuff at LSU, he was also winning national championships. So, and now, you know, he's at a place where, well, what would be considered success for Les Miles' first season? 4-8?
Yeah, that would be a little better than what they've done.
Okay, so I hope he can get there. That video is pretty fantastic.
You like his chances to get to 4-8?
I do not. All right, we'll see you next time.
If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to The Audible on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review while you're at it. It helps get the word out. Thanks to Trader Joe's for being our presenting sponsor. Our producer is Nick Fink. Our theme song is Dangerous by Kevin and the Octaves. You can download their music on iTunes and Spotify. Follow me, Stu, at SL Mandel on Twitter, and Bruce at Bruce Feldman CFB, and subscribe to The Athletic. If you haven't done so already, you can try it for free, 7-day free trial at theathletic.com/free trial. So come on, get over here.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a 1-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.